Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Not Far Away, Not Long Ago by John Collier. He opened the front door, and the two men were standing there. He had always known there would be two of them. He now realized he had always known they would come. Their faces were masked to just below the eyes, but only by the shadow of their hat brims cast by the porch light he had switched on from inside. There was no hope at all of the thrust of a gun and of safety to be bought cheaply by the handing over of a wallet. On the other hand, these two men might be just anybody. They might be two strangers lost in the featureless streets of the still unfinished building development. They had seen his light. They had rung the bell. They wanted to ask how to get to the state highway. Mr. George H. Rogers asked, or perhaps stated, the taller of the two men. Nothing is more banal and more noticeable than to stand opening one's mouth like a fish, uttering no sound. Already the two men were turning to look at each other. In profile, their faces were so colorless and so pointed, they might have been cut from sheets of tin. They looked back at him, and George heard himself saying, "Yes, I'm George Rogers. What is it?" Next moment, he was standing aside, and the two men were walking past him into the hallway. He did not know whether he had stood aside to invite their entry, or whether they had moved to enter, causing him to stand aside. "This will be the living room," said the smaller man. His hand was already on the door, and it was definitely a statement and not a question. George, though shaken, realized that the knowledge did not necessarily imply that these men had been in the house before. The position of the living room was obvious from the outside. Its window was the only large ground floor window in the front of the little house, and there was a light within, for George kept the room ready for the reception of unexpected visitors. His paperback lay open, face down towards, on the arm of the chair. His coffee cup stood almost empty on the table nearby. The room had a lived-in appearance. No one would have thought George had been busy in the kitchen when the sound of the bell, like a long, thin knife, pierced the silence that had been building up day after day within the four walls. The flimsy walls had seemed altogether too thin to hold such a tremendous silence. George felt it must have been heard for miles. However, now it was dead. "All right with you if we have a little chat in the living room, Mr. Rogers?" The three of them had already flowed in there. It was extremely hard to decide whether things were being said and then acted on, or whether the act came first and the speech followed as a sort of trailer. George knew that he was thinking incredibly fast, and that his sensory reactions were perhaps a little slow. "Barging in like this after 10 o'clock at night," said the tall man, "no doubt you're wondering who we are." "You've got a right to know that, Mr. Rogers. My name's McDermott, and this is Mr. Schiller." Exactly on the utterance of each name, first McDermott and then Schiller held out a stiff arm towards George. Each hand, not to be shaken, held a little leather folder. These folders at once fell open and exposed cards, which opened with the folders. On the right was a photograph of the bearer, with an embossed seal with a date scribbled across it and a signature and a fingerprint below. On the left there was the blurred facsimile of a flag, two or three lines of print beneath it, and another signature. The print was clear, and by no means small, but no one can read two cards at once, especially when his senses are lagging far behind his thoughts. George was given time enough, though not more than enough, to read every word. Then the cases were snapped shut. He was left with only the ghost of words fading in his mind's eyes when an illuminated sign is switched off. Its neon legend seems to linger in the air. George felt he could decipher the vanishing outlines of Bureau, perhaps of something freedom, constitution or constitutional, seemed to have been in a line of smaller print underneath. It was certainly, or almost certainly, not Federal Bureau above and investigation in the line below, but, of course, There might be agencies of state police departments with somewhat similar titles with which the ordinary man would have no concern. If it is possible to remember something which had been constantly present in one's mind, waking and sleeping, for several days, George now remembered he was no longer an ordinary man. "What was it you wanted to see me about?" he was saying in a thick voice, rather like that of one suddenly awakened from a fireside nap. Feeling that this would account for everything, he began to rub his eyes and to give the appearance of suppressing a yawn. While he was doing so, he thought of the sharp and wakeful stare with which he had first greeted his visitor, so he stopped. "Well, we certainly want to apologize for stopping by so late," said the taller man, who was perhaps the senior. "But you know how it is, Mr. Rogers. If it wasn't for some people being willing to cooperate after hours, I don't think we'd ever get through. We had the word you were up and around pretty late these nights," put in the smaller man when the other paused. "Mrs. Rogers, having been away for a week or so," continued the tall man. "If our informants aren't altogether haywire," added the other. "Informants?" said George, in a tone of surprise and distaste. "Look at it like this, Mr. Rogers," said the taller man quietly. "We've all have neighbors, you know that." George had always been aware of this. He now became more vividly aware of it than before. The thin walls seemed suddenly transparent. He could see the naked, sleepless houses standing all around in the clear, cold, black night air on lots not yet lawned or hedged, and each house with two upper windows lighted like eyes. "Some of the information we get, well, it's just so much garbage," added the taller man. "We know that, Mr. Rogers, and I want you to know we know it." "It's perfectly true. My wife has been away for the last few days," said George. "She's visiting some friends." "Having a good time, I hope," said the smaller one. "A wonderful time, she says," said George. "I had a letter from her only yesterday." "Yesterday?" asked the taller man. "Yesterday," said George. "Only yesterday," said the taller man, "was Sunday." He was by this time sitting in the armchair opposite George's. His head was tilted back. He might have been speaking to the ceiling. "I meant the day before yesterday," said George. "I meant Saturday. I got a letter from my wife on Saturday, and everything sounded fine." He saw that the smaller man on the upright chair was pulling out a notebook, and he thought it well to add on a note of concern. "Nothing wrong, is there? I mean, not an accident, or—" "Nothing of that sort, Mr. Rogers," said the tall man reassuringly. "Just following a routine lead, just a matter of routine." "Perhaps if you'd be good enough to give us the address," said the smaller man, his pen poised over his book. "The address?" said George. "The name and address of these friends, where she's staying," said the man. "Well, the name, let me see," said George. "The name's Belaine, Mr. and Mrs. Belaine. I sometimes forget the married names. Mrs. Belaine hasn't been married long. Actually, I've never met the husband. Mrs. Belaine and my wife were friends when they were in school." "Would you happen to remember what her name was in those days?" asked the small man. "Well, of course I do," said George. "Naturally I do. Her name was Miss Gavalsky." "That might check," said the tall man again, addressing the ceiling. The smaller man turned back a leaf or two in his notebook. "Not the same," said he. And then, addressing George, "And what did you say the address was, Mr. Rogers?" "Let me explain," said George. "These people, they're not really my friends. In fact, I don't know them at all. They're my wife's friends, as I was saying, and she only heard from Mrs. Belaine after she got married. And she gets this letter asking her to come out there, to Oklahoma, and visit. So she went off with a letter in her purse, and she forgot to write down the address in our book. So when I came to look for it, it wasn't there." "Lucky you got that letter from her on Saturday," observed the smaller one. "Yes," said George, "I was glad to get that letter." "Because that'll give us the address," persisted the other. "It wasn't the letter," said George, "but when I sat down to write to my wife this evening, it seemed like that letter's been mislaid or lost." "Maybe somewhere in all this heap you've got on your desk," said the smaller man, moving that direction. "It's not," said George. "I've looked. I know what's happened. A letter could easily get pushed off over the edge of the desk and fall into the basket at the side there. This afternoon I emptied that basket into the furnace." "You filled it up again pretty quick," said the tall man, turning to look at the full waste paper basket. "Looking for my wife's letter, just now, going through that mess of papers, there was a lot of stuff I threw out." Don't take me for an eager beaver, said a smaller man, but it so happens I've known people just crumple up and chuck away the very paper they're looking for. Mr. Rogers, let me just take a peep through all this junk and see if I can find your wife's letter for you. George, though he knew the man would find nothing, nevertheless felt that this was the point to which to draw the line. It is one thing to be cooperative, to demonstrate that one has nothing to conceal. It is quite another to be cringingly anxious to propitiate. Therefore, as the man sat down at the desk and drew up the waste paper basket, "Now wait a minute," said George, and he frowned. "Now don't tell me to go to hell for asking a very personal question," said the tall man in his extremely level voice, "but just for curiosity, how do you and Mrs. Rogers get along?" At these words, George's frown utterly vanished, and after a momentary interval of gray blankness and exhaustion, he looked as anxious to please as a spaniel or a salesman. "We get along fine," said George. "My wife's a good deal younger than I am, but I'm not ashamed to say we're a devoted couple." "So I suppose Mrs. Rogers won't be staying away very much longer?" said the man at the desk. He was taking crumpled milk bills and marketing lists from the basket, smoothing them out and putting them in a neat pile. "She might stay on another week or two," said George. "As long as she's enjoying herself, it's fine by me. A wife can be very devoted, like you say, and yet take a bit of a vacation," said the taller man. "A couple can be very devoted and yet have a little spat now and then. Would you agree to that, Mr. Rogers?" "My wife and I have never had as much as a—" began George, but then remembering the neighbors, seeing the trap, he interrupted himself with a brief aborted laugh, almost a cough, and continued, "Anything but a spat, as you call it. My wife's got a lot of temperament, and when she blows her top, she blows her top. She makes herself heard. I expect the people next door can confirm that for you, if you haven't asked them already." "We cover most angles," said the tall man with a sort of atrocious modesty. "A little argument," said George. "Well, maybe sometimes a big one, but when it's over, it's over." He stopped for a moment and then added, "I'm very deeply fond of my wife, gentlemen." He used the plural term because he wanted both his visitors to be impressed by what he said, and also because the man at the desk had turned half around and was looking at him. "Mr. Rogers," said the man at the desk, "excuse me for butting into private matters, but have you got something cooking out there at the back?" "My God," said George, "excuse me one minute, if you please." Without waiting an answer, he hurried from the room. The hallway was already full of the smell of burning, or at least of that smell which comes just before the real burning begins. George threw himself open the kitchen door and turned off the gas jet just in time. He lifted the big pot with an effort and got it to the sink and let cold water run in. He wondered for a moment if he dared make quick use of the garbage disposal unit. It was merely a wishful thought. He knew very well it was not a thing that could be done quickly. Moreover, the garbage disposal had begun to vibrate noisily under the strain. So he lifted the pot again and dumped it back on the stove. He turned to go back to the living room and saw the tall man standing in the doorway. "Batching it?" asked the man, looking at the big pot. "Camping out while I'm here by myself," said George. "Enough for a regiment in there," observed the man, indicating the pot. "I cut down on the cooking," said George. "I buy in quantity. Buy enough lamb or veal or whatever to last me quite a time." "Ham and eggs too," said the man, eyeing the topmost plate in the pile. "That's for breakfast," said George. "Mrs. Rogers like ham and eggs?" asked the tall man casually. "If they're good," said George, "why not?" "It's nice when people have the same taste and the same background," said the tall man. "And you give the bones to the dog?" And he pointed down to the floor by the sink. It must have fallen there when George was stabbed by the sound of the bell. "Just a neighborhood mutt," said George. "He likes to come in for a bone." At this moment, George had that feeling which sometimes comes to athletes. He knew he was surpassing himself. He crossed to the doorway, interposing his body between the fragment and the insatiable eyes of the intruder. "They say it's tough on a dog's stomach," said the man, "when he splits the bone that way. They say never give a dog a shank bone, especially a lamb shank, because he splits it up into needles. But maybe that's not a lamb shank. Maybe that bone's too long." George was already beside him in the doorway, and though he had to step for a moment out of the man's line of vision, his hand was already on the switch. "That's a bit of deer meat a friend of mine sent me." He put the light on while he was still speaking. Now the only light was in the hallway, and they turned to it and thus back to the living room. "Nice lot of books you got there," said the smaller man, looking up from the books as they entered. The books were not numerous. The reference must have been to their quality. "This boy, Mickey Spillane, said he, touching the book that lay on the arm of George's chair. "He's got what it takes." Then turning back to the books in the small fireside bookcase. "Highbrow stuff," he said with appreciation, which was none the better for being genuine. "Hemingway, Death in the Afternoon. Brother, I read that book, and I agree with my old professor at NYU. It's one of the classics of our time. Compulsion. A real deep analysis of the rich boy murderers. You ought to read that one, Mac, if you haven't already. I see you've got Raymond Chandler here. Mr. Rogers. I'm not saying that guy didn't have guts, but I wonder if you agree with me. He seemed like he always had a chip on his shoulder. Don't you feel there's a sort of beef between the lines, something he didn't like about our way of life?" "He wrote about crime," said George. "Who likes a criminal?" "Well, it's just one man's opinion," said the other. "That's no reason you shouldn't have whatever book you like on your shelves, Mr. Rogers. And believe me or not, I'll fight to the death for your right to do so. Maybe in return you'll allow me to ask you if you're a follower of Einstein." George heard himself repeating certain words for all the world as if he was ejecting a mouthful of splinters. "Einstein? Me? A follower? But what's he got to—" He did not in the least understand. His mind was too tightly clenched to its one fear and its one purpose for him to make any sort of guess as to why such a question might imply. But as before the sun is visible, there is a lightening of the air that awakens bird and beast. So without any discernible reason, a feeling of heavenly relief mounted up in George, just under the horizon of his consciousness, and he replied in the tone of a man who does not need to reply and who perhaps will not go on replying. "Mr. Schiller, I don't know what sort of wrong tree you're barking up. I'm not a mathematician. I'm not a scientist. I know nothing about Einstein. So if that's all you want to know—" The smaller man reached over, pulled the book from the upper shelf. "This little number," said he to his companion, "is called Out of My Later Years by Albert Einstein." "Oh, that," said George, who had utterly forgotten the book. "That's only essays on science in general and peace and tolerance and that sort of thing." "We stand for tolerance," said a smaller man. "We can understand a guy picking up a book like this just out of curiosity, let's say, when he's browsing around in a second-hand bookstore. That's the way you got a hold of it, maybe, Mr. Rogers?" "No," said George, almost ready to laugh. "It isn't." "Then I guess some friend must have lent it to you," said the smaller man. "Asked you to read it? Wanted to know what you thought of the ideas and all that?" "No one lent it to me," said George. "It's mine. Inside it says E.D. from F.D. Christmas 1950, said the smaller man, opening the book to its fly leaf. "Just for the record, Mr. Rogers, which I believe begins with an R, would you be so kind as to tell us who this E.D. is?" "Those initials were my wife's before she and I got married," said George. "Does that help you? I should have said ours instead of mine." "Eileen Doyle," said the tall man, sounding distinctly bored. "Is my face red?" said his companion ruefully. "Mr. Rogers, I hope you'll let me apologize. I carry the notebook, but my friend here's got the memory." He automatically glanced at the notebook, and then less automatically looked at his companion. "Just trying it on for size," said he. "How about F.D. being the very bird we're interested in? Your wife got any near kin with the initial F?" said a tall man to George. "No," said George, "she hasn't." "Would there be a friend of the family?" pursued the other, "by the name of Floyd Drexel?" "I—" George paused. "Ever heard that name?" said the small man. "I think I've heard my wife mention a young man called Drexel," said George. "If so, it was when she was still in college. He may have given her the book. Probably he did, but—" "What do you know about Mr. Floyd Drexel that leads you to think he's the sort of man who'd give this sort of book to a young girl still in college?" asked the tall man with a certain smooth, cold velocity. "I've never met him," said George. "I know nothing about him." "About his activities?" said the smaller man. "Nothing but his name," said George firmly. "So, gentlemen, if that's all I can do for you, I'm afraid—" "Direct testimony, that's the only thing," said the tall man to his colleague. Then turning to George, "Mr. Rogers," said he, "would you be very kind and make a real effort to remember that address?" "I can't remember it," said George, getting up. "Do me this favor," said the smaller man. "Would you mind just taking this basket, and let's say you've got the furnace open and you're pitching the waste paper in, just show us how you'll go about that." "I don't know," said George. Something like this, I suppose, and he made a half-hearted gesture with the now empty basket. That's fine, said the smaller man. It doesn't need any kind of Einstein's theory to show there could always be the chance of a little crumpled up ball of paper hitting the outside of the furnace and bouncing off into some dark corner you've never noticed. No, said George, his heart sinking again. Nothing fell. I looked, I made sure. I cleaned the whole cellar yesterday, every inch.
You stated it was this afternoon you emptied that basket, said the tall man.
Yes, I said that, and it's true, said George. But you see, I like a tidy cellar. So having cleaned it yesterday, as I said, I looked all around when I emptied the basket. Nothing was dropped. If you want to, you can come down and see. His voice as he uttered these last words was as dull and cold and hard as iron. Not at all the sort of voice for an invitation.
Might as well take a look, said the smaller man, getting to his feet.
It's a bit oppressive down there, said George piteously. It's the deer meat. I told your friend about this friend of mine sending me a whole batch of deer meat. Some of it's down there wrapped up.
You left it there when you cleaned up yesterday, said the tall man.
It's still okay for the dog, said George.
The neighborhood mutt, said the tall man.
I like him to come in. It's pretty lonely, said George. As he spoke, he caught sight of his face in the glass. For a delicious moment, he almost forgot his two visitors. He was so enthralled by the rightness of that word, lonely. But then, as if surging up to meet the lonely face, he felt the rise of a great sigh of tidal wave within him, a wave of desire, of the desire to confess, to confide, to tell all. George rode this wave. He allowed it to sweep him towards his objective. Gentlemen, he said, borrowing its strength and sadness, my wife has left me. He was only just in time. The smaller man was turning toward the door, was opening his mouth to insist. I told you a lie, said George. There's no letter. There never was one. My wife's not in Oklahoma. We have no friends there, but you see, it hurts a man. It humiliates him to have to say his wife has walked out on him. So I've told no one. Or two people. My wife's staying with friends. I'm sorry if I've misled you. But that's how it is.
That's just too bad, said the smaller man. I guess we've been wasting our time. And he actually looked as if he was ready to leave.
Hold it, said the tall man.
Mr. Rogers, I want you to know you've got our sympathy for the breakup of your home. Of course, you've been kidding us all along. So maybe now you'd like to make a little statement?
I don't know what I can say, said George.
Just drawing a bow, said the tall man, is there any possibility she might have gone off with this Floyd Drexel?
She hasn't seen him in years, said George wearily. She's gone to Argentina, if you're really interested.
With a Latin American? Asked the smaller man with renewed alertness.
That's what she said. But she didn't tell me his name, and she didn't tell me his address, said George.
But she made pretty much of a scene before she left? Asked the smaller man. According to our sources, she was just about screaming her head off.
George made some vague gesture of assent, and the smaller man turned to his companion. She shot her mouth off plenty, according to the newspaper account, said the smaller man defensively.
Keep to Drexel, said the tall man. We owe you a bit of an explanation, Mr. Rogers. I guess in view of what you just told us, we're not dropping any bombshell. Anyway, it was back in 51, two couples, well, maybe I'd better say four young people, tried to register at a hotel in a certain resort in Vermont. Your wife was one of the party. Also is Mr. Drexel and a Miss Miriam Jacobs and a Milton Weissman. Don't get me wrong, for all I know, the girls wanted one room and the boys another. Maybe they wanted four single rooms. We don't know. We don't care. We don't pry into people's private lives. Anyway, they never got to first base and registering because the hotel happened to be one of these restricted hotels. We don't take any attitude for or against that sort of thing. But it seems your wife shot off her mouth, as my friend says. However, that's neither here nor there. Mr. Floyd Drexel took a poke at the desk clerk, who I guess was only doing his job. So there was trouble, and it made the local paper. And from there got reprinted in a certain sheet whose back numbers we go through with a fine-tooth comb. A lead like that, you'd be surprised where it takes you. Nothing against Mrs. Rogers, said the smaller man. I mean, she's just a housewife, or was. But she might have remembered something. You see, this Drexel guy, we're getting together quite a file on him.
And if you knew the position that young man is being considered for right now, said the tall man, believe me, Mr. Rogers, you'd be very disturbed. I don't expect Mrs. Rogers is likely to be back here, is she?
No, said George, she's not. Just on the off chance, said the tall man, giving him a card, we'd appreciate a ring. No going all the way down there for testimony, said the smaller man. Some people think we can take joyrides on the old expense account, but we don't operate that way, Mr. Rogers. Sorry we came in at such an unfortunate time. That's quite all right, said George, following them to the door. It's quite all right. Good night, Mr. Rogers, said the tall man. Good night, said the smaller one. Good night, said George. He watched their car drive away, and with its red tail light, it disappeared. He closed the door and went back to the kitchen. In spite of the late hour, and in spite of the clatter of the garbage disposal, he started work again, beginning, of course, with a fragment which lay near the sink. Sardonicus by Ray Russell. In the late summer of the year, 18-something or so, a gratifying series of professional successes had brought me to a state of such fatigue that I had begun seriously to contemplate a long rest on the continent. I had not enjoyed a proper holiday in nearly 3 years, for in addition to my regular practice, I had been deeply involved in a program of research, and so rewarding had been my progress in this special work. It concerned the ligaments and muscles, and could, it was my hope, be beneficially applied to certain varieties of paralysis that I was loath to leave the city for more than a week at a time. Being unmarried, I lacked a solicitous wife who might have expressed concern over my health. Thus it was that I had overworked myself to a point that a holiday had become absolutely essential to my well-being. Hence the letter which was put in my hand one morning near the end of that summer was not welcome. When it was first presented to me by my valet at breakfast, I turned it over and over, feeling the weight of its fine paper, which was almost of the heaviness and stiffness of parchment, pondering the large seal of scarlet wax upon which was imprinted a device of such complexity that it was difficult to decipher, examining finally the hand in which the address had been written, Sir Robert Hargrave, Harley Street, London. It was a feminine hand, that much was certain, and there was a curious touch of familiarity to its delicacy, as well as to its cleanness. This lost an admirable quality far too uncommon in the handwriting of ladies. The fresh clarity of that hand, and where I had seen it before, bespoke a directness that seemed contrary to the well-nigh unfathomable ornamentation of the seal, which upon closer and more concentrated perusal, I at length concluded to be no more than a single S, but an S whose writhing curls seemed almost to grin presumptuously at one, an S which seemed to be constructed of little else than these grins, an S of such vulgar pretension that I admit to having felt vexed for an instant, and then, in the next instant, foolish at my own vexation. For surely, I admonish myself, there are things a deal more vexing than a seal which you have encountered without distemper. Smiling at my foible, I continued to weigh the letter in my hand, searching my mind for a friend or acquaintance whose name began with S. There was old Shipley of the College of Surgeons. There was Lord Henry Stanton, my waggish and witty friend, and that was the extent of it. Was it Harry? He was seldom in one place for very long, and was a faithful and gifted letter writer. Yet Harry's bold hand was far from effeminate, and moreover, he would not use such a seal, unless it were as a lark, as an antic jest between friends. Mavelet had told me when he put the letter in my hand that it had not come by the post but by special messenger. And although this intelligence had not struck me as remarkable at the time, it now fed my curiosity, and I broke that vexing seal and unfolded the stiff, crackling paper. The message within was written in the same clear, faintly familiar hand. My eye first traveled to the end to find the signature, but that signature, Madam S., told me nothing, for I knew of no Madam S. among my circle. I read the letter. It is before me now as I set down this account, and I shall copy it out verbatim. My dear Sir Robert, it has been close to 7 years since we last met. Indeed, at that time you were not yet Sir Robert at all, but plain Robert Cargrave, although some talk of imminent knighthood was in the air. And so I wonder if you will remember Maud Randall. Remember Maud Randall? Dear Maud of the bell-like voice, of the chestnut hair and large brown eyes, of a temperament of such sweetness and vivacity that the young men of London had eyes for no one else. She was of good family, but during a stay in Paris, there had been something about injudicious speculation by her father that had diminished the family's fortune to such an extent that the wretched man had taken his own life, and the Randalls had vanished from London society altogether. Maud, or so I had heard, had married a foreign gentleman and had remained in Europe. It had been sad news, for no young man of London had ever had more doting eyes for Maud than I had, and it had pleased my fancy to think that my feelings were, at least in part, reciprocated. Remember Maud Randall? Yes, yes, I almost said aloud. And now, 7 years later, she was Madam S. I often think of you, she wrote, in that hand that I had seen countless times on invitations, although may not be seemly to say it, the company of few gentlemen used to please me so much as yours and the London soirees, given by my dear mother at which you were present, are among my most cherished recollections now. But there, frankness was always my failing, as mother used to remind me. She, dear kind lady, survived less than a year after my poor father died, and I suppose you know this. I am quite well, and we live in great comfort here, although we receive but rarely and are content with our own company most of the time. Mr. S. is a gracious gentleman, but of quiet and retiring disposition, and throngs of people, parties, balls, are retrograde to his temperament. Thus it is a special joy to me that he has expressly asked me to invite you here to the castle for a fortnight, or, if I may give you his exact words, for a fortnight at least. But howsoever long as it please Sir Robert to stay among such drab folk as he will think us. You see, I told you he was gracious. I must have frowned while reading, for the words of Mr. S. were not so much gracious, I thought, as egregious, and as vulgar as his absurd zeal. Still, I held these feelings in check, for I knew that my emotions towards this man were not a little colored by jealousy. He, after all, had wooed and won Maud Randall, a young lady of discernment and fine sensibilities. Could she have been capable of wedding an obsequious boor? I thought it not likely. And a castle, such romantic grandeur. Invite you here to the castle, she had written, but where was here? The letter's cover, since it had not come by post, offered no clue, therefore I read on. It was indeed only yesterday, in the course of conversation, that I was recalling my old life in London, and mentioned your name. Mr. S., I thought, was of sudden interest. Robert Cargrave, he said, there's a well-known physician of that name, but I do not imagine it is the same gentleman. I laughed and told him it was the same gentleman, and that I had known you before you had become so illustrious. Did you know him well? Mr. S. then asked me. And you will think me silly, but I must tell you that for a moment I assumed him to be jealous. Such was not the case. However, as further conversation proved, I told him you had been a friend of my family's and a frequent guest at our house. This is a most happy coincidence, he said. I have long desired to meet Sir Robert Cargrave, and your past friendship with him furnishes you with an excellent opportunity to invite him here for a holiday. And so, Sir Robert, I am complying with this request and, at the same time, obeying the dictates of my own inclination. By most cordially inviting you to visit us for as long as you choose, I entreat you to come, for we see so few people here. It would be a great pleasure to talk with someone from the old days and to hear the latest London gossip. Suffer me, then, to receive a letter from you at once. Mr. S. does not trust the post. Hence, I have sent this by a servant of ours who was to be in London on special business. Please relay your answer by way of him. I rang for my man. It's the messenger who delivered this letter, waiting for a reply, I asked. He is sitting in the vestibule, Sir Robert, he said. You should have told me. Yes, sir. At any rate, send him in now. I wish to see him. My man left, and it took me but a minute to dash off a quick note of acceptance. It was ready for the messenger when he was ushered into the room. I addressed him. You are in the employ of Madame, and I realized for the first time that I did not know her husband's name. The servant, a taciturn fellow with Slavic features, spoke in a thick accent. I am in the employ of Mr. Sardonicus, sir. Sardonicus. A name as flamboyant as the seal, I thought to myself. Then deliver this note, if you please, to Madame Sardonicus immediately you return. He bowed slightly and took the note from my hand. I shall deliver it to my master straight away, sir, he said. His manner nettled me. I corrected him. To your mistress, I said coldly. Madame Sardonicus will receive your message, sir, he said. I dismissed him, and only then did it strike me that I had not the faintest idea where the castle of Mr. Sardonicus was located. I referred once again to Maud's letter. Please relay your answer by way of him, and pray make it affirmative, for I do hope to make your stay in a pleasant one. I consulted an atlas. The locality she mentioned I discovered was a district in a remote and mountainous region of Bohemia. Filled with anticipation, I finished my breakfast with renewed appetite, and that very afternoon began to make arrangements for my journey. Part 2. The Sight of a Giant Skull. I am not, as my friend Harry Stanton is, fond of travel for its own sake. Harry has often chided me on this account, calling me a dry-as-dust academician and an incorrigible Londoner, which I suppose I am. From point of fact, few things are more tiresome to me than ships and trains and carriages, and although I have found deep enjoyment and spiritual profit in foreign cities, having arrived, the tedium of travel itself has often made me think twice before starting out on a long voyage. Still, in less than a month after I had answered Maud's invitation, I found myself in her adopted homeland. Sojourning from London to Paris, thence to Berlin, finally to Bohemia, I was met by a coachman who spoke imperfect English, but who managed in a solemn fashion to make it known to me that he was a member of the staff at Castle Sardonicus. He placed at my disposal a coach drawn by two horses, and after taking my bags proceeded to drive me on the last leg of my journey. Alone in the coach, I shivered, for the air was brisk, and I was very tired. The road was full of ruts and stones, and the trip was far from smooth. Neither did I derive much pleasure by bending my glance to the view afforded by the windows, for the night was dark, and the country was, at any rate, wild and raw, not made for serene contemplation. The only sound were the clatter of hoofs and wheels, the creak of the coach, and the harsh, unmusical cries of unseen birds. We received but rarely, Maud had written, and now, I told myself, little wonder, in this ragged and, one might say, uninhabitable place, far from the graces of civilized society. Who indeed is there to be received, or for the matter of that, to receive one? I sighed, for the desolate landscape and the thought of what might prove a holiday devoid of refreshing incident had combined to cloak my already wearied spirit in a melancholic humor. It was when I was in this condition that Castle Sardonicus met my eye, a dense, hunched outline at first, then with an instantaneous flicker of moonlight, a great, gaping death's head, the sight of which made me inhale sharply. With the exhalation, I chuckled at myself. "Come, come, Sir Robert," I inwardly chided. "It is, after all, but a castle, and you are not a green girl who starts at shadows and quails at midnight stories." The castle is situated at the terminus of a long and upward-winding mountain road. It presents a somewhat forbidding aspect to the world, for there is little about it to suggest gaiety or warmth or any of those qualities that might assure the wayfarer of welcome. Rather, this vast edifice of stone exudes an austerity, cold and repellent, a hint of ancient mysteries long buried, an effluvium of medieval dankness and decay. At night, and most particularly on nights when the moon is slim or cloud enshrouded, it is a heavy blot upon the horizon, a shadow only, without features save for its many turreted outlines, and should the moon be temporarily released from her cloudy confinement, her fugitive rays lent scant comfort, for they but serve to throw the castle into sudden, startling chiaroscuro, its windows fleetingly assuming the appearance of sightless, though all-seeing orbs, its portcullis becoming for an instant a gaping mouth, its entire form striking the physical and the mental eyes with the sight of a giant skull. But though the castle had revealed itself to my sight, it was a full quarter of an hour before the coach had creaked its way up the steep and tortuous road to the great gate that barred the castle grounds from intruders. Of iron the gate was wrought, black it seemed in the scant illumination, and composed of intricate twists that led every one of them to a central huge device of many curves, which in the infrequent glints of moon glow appeared to smile metallically down, but which, upon gathering my reason about me, I made out to be no more than an enlarged edition of the presumptuous seal, a massive single S. Behind it, at the end of the rutted road, stood the castle itself, dark, save for lights in two of its many windows. Some words in a foreign language passed between my coachman and a person behind the gate. The gate was unlocked and from within and swung open slowly, with a long rising shriek of rusted hinges, and the coach passed through. As we drew near, the door of the castle was flung open, and cheery light spilled out upon the road. The portcullis, which had I previously marked, was evidently a remnant from older days, and now inactive. The coach drew to a halt, and I was greeted with great gravity by a butler whom I saw to be he who had carried Maud's invitation to London. I proffered him a nod of recognition. He acknowledged this and said, "Sir Robert, Madame Sardonicus awaits you, and if you will be good enough to follow me, I will take you to her presence." The coachman took charge of my bags, and I followed the butler into the castle. It dated, I thought, to the 12th or 13th century. Suits of armor, priceless relics I certain them to be, stood about the vast halls. Tapestries were in evidence throughout. Strong, heavy, richly carved furniture was everywhere. The walls were of time-defying stone, great gray blocks of it. I was led into a kind of salon with comfortable chairs, a tea-table, and a spinet. Maud rose to greet me. "Sir Robert," she said softly, without smiling, "how good to see you at last." I took her hand. "Dear lady," said I, "we meet again." "You are looking well and prosperous," she said. "I am in good health, but just now rather tired from the journey." She gave me leave to sit, and did so herself, venturing the opinion that a meal and some wine would soon restore me. "Mr. Sardonicus will join us soon," she added. I spoke of her appearance, saying that she looked not a day older than when I last saw her in London. This was true in regard to her physical self, for her face bore not a line. Her skin was of the same freshness, and her glorious chestnut hair was still rich in color and gleaming with health. But what I did not speak of was the change in her spirit. She, who had been so gay and vivacious, the delight of soirees, was now distant and aloof. Of serious mien, unsmiling. I was sorry to see this, but attributed it to the last 7 years that had passed since her carefree girlhood, to the loss of her beloved parents, and even to the secluded life she now spent in this place. "I am eager to meet your husband," I said. "And he, Sir Robert, is quite eager to meet you," Maud assured me. "He will be down presently. Meanwhile, do tell me how you have fared in the world." I spoke with some modesty, I hope, of my successes in my chosen field, of the knighthood I had received from the crown. I described my London apartment, laboratory, and office. I made mention of certain mutual friends, and generally gave her news of London life, speaking particularly of the theater, for I knew Maud had loved it, and describing Mr. Macready's farewell appearance as Macbeth at the Haymarket. When Maud had last been in London, there had been rumors of making an opera house out of Covent Garden Theatre, and I told her that those plans had been carried through. I spoke of the London premiere of Mr. Verdi's latest over at Her Majesty's. My mention of these theatres and performances, her eyes lit up, but she was not moved to comment until I spoke of the opera. "The opera," she sighed. "Oh, Sir Robert, if you could but know how I miss it. The excitement of a premiere, the ladies and gentlemen in their finery, the thrilling sounds of the overture, and then the curtain rising." She broke off as if ashamed of her momentary transport. "But I receive all the latest scores, and derive great satisfaction from playing and singing them to myself. I must order the new Verdi from Rome. It is called Ernani, you say?" I nodded, adding, "With your permission, I will attempt to play some of the more distinctive airs." "Oh, pray do, Sir Robert," she said. "You will find them perhaps excessively modern and dissonant." I sat down at the spinet and played, just passably, I fear, and with some improvisation, when I could not remember the exact notes, a potpourri of melodies from the opera. She applauded my playing. I urged her to play also, for she was an accomplished keyboard artist, and possessed an agreeable voice as well. She complied by playing the minuet from Don Giovanni, and then singing Wa Che Sapete from Le Nozze di Figaro. As I stood over her, watching her delicate hands move over the keys, hearing the pure, clear tones of her voice, all of my old feelings washed over me in a rush, and my eyes smarted at the unalloyed sweetness and goodness of this lady. When she asked me to join her in the duet, La si da la mano. I agreed to do it, although my voice is less than ordinary. On the second singing of the word mano, hand, I was seized by a vagrant impulse and took her left hand in my own. Her playing was hampered, of course, and the music limped for a few measures, and then, my face burning, I released her hand and we finished out the duet. Wisely, she neither rebuked me for my action nor gave me encouragement. Rather, she acted as if the rash gesture had never been committed. To mask my embarrassment, I now embarked upon some light chatter, designed to ease whatever tension existed between us. I spoke of many things, foolish things, for the most part, and even asked if Mr. Sardonicus had later demonstrated any of the jealousy she had said in her letter that she had erroneously thought him to have exhibited. She laughed at this, and it brightened the room, for it was the first time her face had abandoned its grave expression. Indeed, I was taken by the thought that this was the first display of human merriment I had marked since stepping into the coach, and she said, "Oh, no, to the contrary. Mr. Sardonicus said that the closer we had been in the old days, the more he would be pleased." This seemed an odd and even coarse thing for a man to say to his wife, and I jovially replied, "I hope Mr. Sardonicus was smiling when he said that." At once, Maud's own smile vanished from her face. She looked away from me and began to talk of other things. I was dumbfounded. Had my innocent remark given offense? It seemed not possible. A moment later, however, I knew the reason for her strange action, for a tall gentleman entered the room with a gliding step, and one look at him explained many things. Part 3. He Who Must Smile Forever. "Sir Robert Cargrave," he asked, but he spoke with difficulty certain sounds, such as the B in Robert and the V in Cargrave, being almost impossible for him to utter. To shape these sounds, the lips must be used, and the gentleman before me was the victim of some terrible affliction that had caused his lips to be pulled perpetually apart from each other, baring his teeth in a continuous ghastly smile. It was the same humorless grin I had seen once before on the face of a person in the last throes of lockjaw. We physicians have a name for that chilling grimace, a Latin name, and it is entered my mind, it seemed to dispel yet another mystery, for the term we used to describe the lockjaw smile is rhesus sardonicus, a pallor approaching phosphorescence completed his astonishing appearance. "Yes," I replied, covering my shock at the sight of his face. "Do I have the pleasure of addressing Mr. Sardonicus?" We shook hands. After an exchange of courtesies, he said, "I have ordered dinner to be served in a large dining hall, 1 hour hence. In the meantime, my valet will show you to your room, for I am sure you will wish to refresh yourself after your journey." "You're most kind." The valet appeared, a man of grave countenance, like the butler and the coachman, and I followed him up a long flight of stone stairs. As I walked behind him, I reflected on the unsmiling faces in this castle, and no longer were they things of wonder, for who would be disposed to smile on the same roof with him who must smile forever? The most spontaneous of smiles would seem a mockery in the presence of that afflicted face. I was filled with pity for Maud's husband. Of all God's creatures, man alone is blessed with the ability to smile. But for the master of Castle Sardonicus, God's great blessing had become a terrible curse. As a physician, my pity was tempered with professional curiosity. His smile resembled the rhesus of lockjaw, but lockjaw is a mortal disease, and Mr. Sardonicus, his skullish grin notwithstanding, was very much alive. I felt shame for some of my earlier uncharitable thoughts towards this gentleman, for surely such an unfortunate could be forgiven much. What bitterness must fester in his breast, what sharp despair gnaw at his innards. My room was spacious and certainly as comfortable as this dank stone housing could afford. A hot tub was prepared, for which my tired and dusty frame was most grateful. As I lay in it, I began to experience the pleasant pang of appetite. I looked forward to dinner. After my bath, I put on fresh linen and a suit of evening clothes. Then, taking from my bags two small gifts from my host and hostess, a bottle of scent for Maud, a box of cigars for her husband, I left my rooms. I was not so foolish as to expect to find my way, unaided, to the main dining hall. But since I was early, I intended to wander a bit and let the ancient magnificence of the castle impress itself upon me. Tapestries bearing my hostess are frequently displayed. They were remarkably new, their colors fresh, unlike the faded grandeur of their fellow tapestries. From this and from Mr. Sardonicus's lack of title, I deduced that the castle had not been inherited through a family line, but merely purchased by him, probably from an impoverished nobleman. Though not titled, Mr. Sardonicus evidently possessed enormous wealth. I pondered its source. My ponderings were interrupted by the sound of Maud's voice. I looked up. The acoustical effects in old castles are often strange. I had marked them in our own English castles, and though I stood neither room nor door of any kind, I could hear Maud speaking in a distressed tone. I was standing at an open window which overlooked a kind of courtyard. Across this court a window that was likewise open. I took this to be the window of Maud's room. Her voice was in some way being amplified and transported by the circumstantial shape of the courtyard and the position of the two windows. By listening very attentively, I could make out most of her words. She was saying, "I shan't. You must not ask me. It is unseemly." And then the voice of her husband replied, "You shall and will, madam. In my castle, it is I who decide what is seemly or unseemly, not you." I was embarrassed at overhearing this private discussion and was obviously a painful subject. So I made to draw away from the window that I might hear no more, but was restrained by the sound of my own name on Maud's lips. "I have treated Sir Robert with courtesy," she said. "You must treat him with more than courtesy," Mr. Sardonicus responded. "You must treat him with warmth. You must rekindle in his breast those affections he felt for you in other days." I could listen no longer. The exchange was vile. I drew away from the window. What manner of creature was this Sardonicus, who threw his wife into the arms of other men? As a practitioner of medicine, a man dedicated to healing the ills of humankind, I had brought myself to learn many things about the minds of men, as well as about their bodies. I fully believed that in some future time, physicians would heal the body by way of the mind, for it is in that terra incognita that all secrets lie hidden. I knew that love has many masks, masks of submission and of oppression, and even more terrible masks that make nature a stranger to herself and turn the truth of God into a lie, as St. Paul wrote. There is even a kind of love, if it can be elevated by that name, that derives its keenest pleasure from the sight of the beloved in the arms of another. These are unpleasant observations, which may one day be codified and studied by healers, but which, until then, may not be thought on for too long, lest the mind grow morbid and stagger under its load of repugnance. With a heavy heart, I sought out a servant and asked to be taken to the dining hall. It was some distance away, and by the time I arrived there, Sardonicus and his lady were already at the table awaiting me. He arose, and with a revolting smile indicated a chair. She also rose and took my arm, addressing me as "Dear Sir Robert," and leading me to my place. Her touch, which at any previous time would have gladdened me, I now found distinctly not to my liking. A hollow joviality hung over the table throughout the meal. Maud's laughter struck me as giddy and false. Sardonicus drank too much wine, and his speech became even more indistinct. I contrived to talk on trivial subjects, repeating some anecdotes about the London theatre, which I had hitherto related to Maud, and describing Macready's interpretation of Macbeth. "Some actors," said Sardonicus, "interpret the Scottish chieftain as a creature compounded of pure evil, unmingled with good qualities of any kind. Such interpretations are often criticized by those who feel no human being can be so unremittingly evil. Do you agree, Sir Robert?" "No," I said, evenly, then looking Sardonicus full in the face, I added, "I believe it is entirely possible for a man to possess not a single one of the virtues, to be a demon in human flesh." Quickly I embarked upon a discussion of the character of Iago, who took ghoulish delight in tormenting his fellow man. The dinner was, I suppose, first rate, and the wine an honorable vintage, but I confess to tasting little of what was placed before me. At the end of the meal, Maud left us for a time, and Sardonicus escorted me into the library with her. He ordered brandy to be brought. He opened the box of cigars, expressed his admiration of them and gratitude for them, and offered them to me. I took one, and we both smoked. The smoking of a cigar made Sardonicus look even more grotesque. Being unable to hold it in his lips, he clenched it in his constantly visible teeth, creating a unique spectacle. Brandy was served. I partook of it freely, though I am not customarily given to heavy drinking, for now I deemed it to be beneficial to my dampened spirits. "You used the word ghoulish a few moments ago, Sir Robert," said Sardonicus. It is one of those words one uses so easily in conversation. One utters it without stopping to think of its meaning. But in my opinion, it is not a word to be used lightly. When one uses it, one should have in one's mind a firm, unwavering picture of a ghoul. Perhaps I did, I said. Perhaps, he admitted, and perhaps not. Let us obtain a precise definition of the word. He arose and walked to one of the bookcases that lined the room's walls. He reached for a large 2-volume dictionary. Let me see, he murmured. We desire volume 1 from A to M, do we not? Now. Then, Gi, Gherkin, Ghetto, Goom, an odd word. Sir Robert? To search for game in the dark. Ghost, ah. Ghoul. Among Eastern nations, an imaginary evil being who robs graves and feeds upon corpses. One might say, then, that he gooms? Sardonicus chuckled. He returned to his chair and helped himself to more brandy. When you describe Iago's actions as ghoulish, he continued, did you think of him as the inhabitant of an Eastern nation, or an imaginary being as against the reality of Othello and Desdemona? And did you mean seriously to suggest that it was his custom to rob graves and then to feed upon the disgusting nourishment he found therein? I used the word in a figurative sense, I replied. Ah, said Sardonicus, that is because you are English and do not believe in ghouls. Were you a Middle European, as am I, you would believe in their existence and would not be tempted to use the word other than literally. In my country, I was born in Poland, we understand such things. I, in point of fact, have known a ghoul. He paused for a moment and looked at me, then said, you English are so blasé. Nothing shocks you. I sit here and tell you a thing of dreadful import, and you do not even blink your eyes. Can it be because you do not believe me? It would be churlish to doubt the word of my host, I replied. And an Englishman may be many things, but never a churl. Sir Robert, let me refill your glass, my friend, and then let me tell you about ghouls, which, by the way, are by no means imaginary, as that stupid lexicon would have us think, and which are not restricted to Eastern nations. Neither do they necessarily feed upon carrion flesh, although they are interested, most interested, in the repellent contents of graves. Let me tell you a story from my own country, Sir Robert, a story that, if I have any gift at all as a spinner of tales, will create in you a profound belief in ghouls. You will be entertained, I hope, but I also hope you will add to your learning. You will learn, for example, how low a human being can sink, how truly monstrous a man can become. Part 4. The Moon, His Undoing. You must transport your mind, said Sardonicus, back a few years to a rural region of my homeland. You must become acquainted with a family of country folk, hard-working, law-abiding, God-fearing, of moderate means, the head of which was a simple, good-natured man named Tadeusz Boleski. He was an even-tempered personage, kindly disposed to all men, the loving husband of a devoted wife and father of 5 strong boys. He was also a firm churchman, seldom even taking the Lord's name in vain. The painted women who plied their trade in certain elaborate houses of the nearest large city, Warsaw, held no attraction for him, though several of his masculine neighbors on their visits to the metropolis still come to such blandishments with title regularity. Neither did he think or drink in excess. A glass of beer with his evening meal, a toast or two and wine on special occasions. No, hard liquor, strong language, fast women, these were not the weakness of Tadeusz Boleski. His weakness was gambling. Every month, he would make the trip to Warsaw to sell his produce at the markets and to buy certain necessaries for his home. While his comrades visited the drinking and wenching houses, Tadeusz would attend strictly to business affairs, except for one minor deviation. He would purchase a lottery ticket, place it securely in a small tight pocket of his best waistcoat, which he wore only on Sundays and on his trips to the city, then put it completely out of his mind until the following month, when on reaching the city he would remove it from his pocket and closely scan the posted list of winners. Then, after methodically tearing the ticket to shreds, for Tadeusz never lived to win a lottery, he would purchase another. This was a ritual with him. He performed it every month for 23 years, and the fact that he never won did not discourage him. His wife knew of this habit, but since it was the good man's only flaw, she never remarked upon it. Outside, I could hear the wind howling dismally. I took more brandy as Sardonicus continued. Years pass. 3 of the 5 sons married. 2, Henrik and Marek, the youngest, were still living with their parents when Tadus, who had been of sturdy health, collapsed one day in the field and died. I'll spare you an account of the family's grief, how the married sons returned with their wives to attend the obsequies of the burial in the small graveyard of that community. The good man had left few possessions, but these few were divided according to his written wish among his survivors, with the largest share going, of course, to the eldest son. Though this was the custom, the other sons could not help feeling a trifle disgruntled, but they held their peace for the most part, especially the youngest, Marek, who was perhaps the most amiable of them, and a lad who was by nature quiet and interested in improving his lot through the learning he found in books. Imagine, sir, the amazement of the widow when, a full 3 weeks after the interment of her husband, she received word by men returning from Warsaw that the lottery ticket Tadeusz had purchased had now been selected as the winner. It was a remarkable irony, of course, but conditions had grown hard for the poor woman, whom would grow harder with her husband dead, so she had no time to reflect upon that irony. She set about looking through her husband's possession for the lottery ticket. Drawers were emptied upon the floors, boxes and cupboards were ransacked. The family Bible was shaken out. Years before, Tadeusz had been in the habit of temporarily hiding money under a loose floorboard in the bedroom. This cavity was thoroughly but vainly plumbed. The sons were sent for. Among the few personal effects they had been bequeathed, did the ticket languish there? In the snuff-box? In any article of clothing? And at that, Sir Robert, the eldest son, leapt up. "An article of clothing?" he cried. "Father always wore his Sunday waistcoat to the city when he purchased the lottery ticket, the very waistcoat in which he was buried." "Yes, yes," the other sons chorused, saving Marek, and plans began to be laid for the exhuming of the dead man. But the widow spoke firmly. "Your father rests peacefully," she said. "He must not be disturbed. No amount of gold would soothe our hearts if we disturbed him." The sons protested with vehemence, but the widow stood her ground. "No son of mine will profane his father's grave unless he first kills his mother." Grumbling, the sons withdrew their plans. But that night, Marek awoke to find his mother gone from the house. He was frightened, for this was not like her. Intuition sent him to the graveyard, where he found her keeping a lonely vigil over the grave of her husband, protecting him from the greed of grave robbers. Marek implored her to come out of the cold, to return home. She at first refused. Only when Marek offered to keep vigil all night himself did she relent and return home, leaving her youngest son to guard the grave from profanation. Marek waited a full hour. Then he produced from under his shirt a small shovel. He was a strong boy, and the greed of a youngest son who had been deprived of inheritance lent added strength to his arms. He dug relentlessly, stopping seldom for rest until finally the coffin was uncovered. He raised the creaking lid. An overpowering fetor filled his nostrils and nearly made him faint. Gathering courage, he searched the pockets of the moldering waistcoat. The moon proved to be his undoing, Sir Robert, for suddenly its rays, hitherto hidden, struck the face of his father, and at the sight of that face, the boy recoiled and went reeling against the wall of the grave, the breath forced from his body. Now, you must know that the mere sight of his father, even in an advanced state of decomposition, he had steeled himself to withstand. But what he had not foreseen. Here Sardonicus leaned close to me, and his pallid, grinning head filled my vision. What he had not foreseen, my dear sir, was that the face of his father, in the rigor of death, would look directly and hideously upon him. Sardonicus' voice became an ophidian hiss. "And Sir Robert," he added, "most terrible and most unforeseen of all, the dead lips were drawn back from the teeth in a constant and soul-shattering smile." Part 5. The Remembrance of That Night. I know not whether it was the ghastliness of his story, or the sight of his hideous face so close to mine, or the cheerless keening of the wind outside, or the brandy he had consumed, of all of these in combination, but when Sardonicus uttered those last words, my heart was clutched by a cold hand, and for a moment, a long moment, ripped from the texture of time, I was convinced beyond doubt and beyond logic that the face I looked into was the face of that cadaver, reanimated by obscure arts to walk among the living, dead though not dead. The moment of horror passed at length, and reason triumphed. Sardonicus, considerably affected by his own tale, sat back in his chair, trembling. Before too long, he spoke again. "The remembrance of that night, Sir Robert, though it is now many years past, fills me still with dread. You will appreciate this when I tell you, what you have perhaps already guessed, that I am that ghoulish son, Merrick. I had not guessed it, but since I had no wish to tell him that, I for an instant thought he was the dead father. I said nothing. When my senses returned," says Sardonicus, "I scrambled out of the grave and ran as swiftly as my limbs would carry me. I had reached the gate of the graveyard when I was smitten by the fact that I had not accomplished the purpose of my mission. The lottery ticket remained in my father's pocket. But surely," I started to say, "surely I ignored the fact and continued to run. No, Sir Robert. My terror notwithstanding, I halted and forced myself to retrace those hasty steps. My fear notwithstanding, I descended once more into that noisome grave. My disgust notwithstanding, I reached into the pocket of my decaying father's waistcoat and extracted the ticket. I need hardly add that this time I averted my eyes from his face. But the horror was not behind me. Indeed, it had only begun. I reached my home at a late hour, and my family was asleep. For this I was grateful, since my clothes were covered with soil, and I still trembled with my fearful experience. I quietly poured water into a basin and prepared to wash some of the graveyard dirt from my face and hands. In performing my ablutions, I looked up into a mirror and screamed so loudly as to wake the entire house. My face was, as you see it now, a replica of my dead father's, the lips drawn back in a perpetual mocking grin. I tried to close my mouth. I could not. The muscles were immovable, as if held in the gallid rigor of death. I could hear my family stirring at my screams, and since I did not wish them to look upon me, I ran from the house, never, Sir Robert, to return. As I wandered the rural roads, my mind sought the cause of the affliction that had been visited upon me. Though but a country lad, I had read much, and I had a blunt, rational mind that was not susceptible to the easy explanations of the supernatural. I would not believe that God had placed a malediction upon me to punish me for my act. I would not believe that some black force from beyond the grave had reached out to stamp my face. At length I began to believe it was the massive shock that had forced my face to its present state, and that my great guilt had helped to shape it, even as my father's dead face was shaped. Shock and guilt, strong powers not from God above or the fiend below, but from within my own breast, my own brain, my own soul. Let me bring this history to a hasty close, Sir Robert. You need only know that despite my blighted face, I redeemed the lottery ticket and thus gained an amount of money that will not seem large to you, but which was more than I had ever seen before that time. It was a fulcrum from which I plied the lever that was to make me, by dint of shrewd speculation, one of the richest men in Central Europe. Naturally, I sought out physicians and begged them to restore my face to its previous state. None succeeded. Though I offered them vast sums, my face remained fixed in this damnable, unceasing smile, and my heart knew the most profound despair imaginable. I could not even pronounce my own name. By a dreadful irony, the initial letters of my first and last names were impossible for my frozen lips to form. This seemed the final indignity. I will admit to you that at this period I was perilously near the brink of self-destruction, but the spirit of preservation prevailed, and I was saved from that course. I changed my name. I had read of the Rhesus Sardonicus, and its horrible aptness appealed to my brittle mind, so I became Sardonicus, a name I can pronounce with no difficulty. Sardonicus paused and sipped his brandy. "You are wondering," he then said, "in what way my story concerns you?" I could guess, but I said, "I am." "Sir Robert," he said, "you are known throughout the medical world. Most laymen perhaps have not heard of you, but a layman such as I, a layman who avidly follows the medical journals for tidings of any recent discoveries in the curing of paralyzed muscles, has heard of you again and again. Your researches into these problems have earned you high professional regard. Indeed, they have earned you a knighthood. For some time it has been in my mind to visit London and seek you out. I have consulted many physicians, renowned men, Keller in Berlin, Morgnac in Paris, Buonagente in Milan, and none have been able to help me. My despair has been utter. It prevented me from making the long journey to England. But when I heard, sublime coincidence, that my own wife had been acquainted with you, I took heart. Sir Robert, I entreat you to heal me, to lift from me this curse, to make me look once more like a man, that I may walk in the sun again, among my fellow human beings, as one of them, rather than as a fearsome gargoyle, to be shunned and feared and ridiculed. Surely you cannot, will not deny me. My feelings for Sardonicus, pendulum-like again, swung towards his favor. His story, his plight, had rent my heart, and I reverted to my earlier opinion that such a man should be forgiven much. The strange overheard conversation between Maud and him was momentarily forgotten. I said, I will examine you, Mr. Sardonicus. You were right to ask me. We must never abandon hope. He clasped his hands together. Ah, sir, may you be blessed forever. I performed the examination then and there. Although I did not tell him this, never had I encountered muscles as rigid as those of his face. They could only be compared to stone, so inflexible were they. Still, I said, tomorrow we'll begin treatment, heat and massage. These have been tried, he said hopelessly. Massage differs from one pair of hands to another, I replied. I've had success with my own techniques and therefore place faith in them. Be comforted then, sir, and share my faith. He seized my hand in his. I do, he said. I must. For if even you, Sir Robert Cargrave, fail me. He did not complete the sentence, but his eyes assumed an aspect so bitter, so full of hate, so strangely cold yet flaming that they floated in my dreams that night. Part 6. An abyss of humiliation and shame. I slept not well, awakening many times in a fever compounded of drink and turbulent emotions. When the first rays of morning crept onto my pillow, I rose, little refreshed. After a cold tub and a light breakfast in my room, I went below to the salon whence music issued. Maud was already there playing a pretty little piece upon the spinet. She looked up and greeted me. Good morning, Sir Robert. Do you know the music of Mr. Gottschalk? He is an American pianist. This is his maiden's blush. Amiable, is it not? Most amiable, I replied dutifully, although I was in no mood for the embroideries of politesse. Maud soon finished the piece and closed the album. She turned to me and said in a serious tone, I have been told that you are going to do something for my poor husband, Sir Robert. I can scarce express my gratitude. There is no need to express it, I assured her. As a physician, as well as your old friend, I could not do less. I hope you understand, however, that a cure is not a certainty. I will try, and I will try to the limit of my powers, but beyond that I can promise nothing. Her eyes shone with supplication. Oh, cure him, Sir Robert. That I beg of you. I understand your feelings, madam, I said. It is fitting that you should hope so fervently for his recovery. A devoted wife could feel no other way. Oh, sir, she said, and into her voice crept now a harshness. You misunderstand. My fervent hope springs from unalloyed selfishness. How may that be? I asked. If you do not succeed in curing him, she told me, I will suffer. I understand that, but no, you do not understand, she said. But I can tell you little more without offending. Some things are better left unspoken. Suffice it to be said that in order to urge you towards an ultimate effort, to the limit of your powers, as you have just said, my husband intends to hold over your head the threat of my punishment. That is monstrous, I cried. It cannot be tolerated. But in what manner, pray, would he dare punish you? Surely he would not beat you. I wish he would be content with a mere beating, she groaned, but his cleverness knows a keener torture. No, he holds over me, and over you through me, a punishment far greater, a punishment, believe me, so loathsome to the sensibilities, so vile and degraded that my mind shrinks from contemplating it. Spare me your further questions, sir, I enjoin you, for to describe it would plunge me into an abyss of humiliation and shame. She broke into sobbing, and tears coursed down her cheeks. No longer able to restrain my tender feelings for her, I flew to her side and took her hands in mine. "Maud," I said, "may I call you that? In the past I addressed you only as Miss Randall. At present I may only call you Madame Sardonicus, but in my heart, then as now, you are, you have always been, you will always be simply Maud, my own dear Maud." "Robert," she sighed, "dearest Robert, I have yearned to hear my Christian name from your lips all these long years." "The warmth we feel," I said, "may never with honor reach fulfillment, but trust me, dearest Maud, I will in some wise way deliver you from the tyranny of that creature. This I vow." "I have no hope," she said, "save in you. Whether I go on as I am, or am subjected to an unspeakable horror, rest with you. My fate is in your hands. These strong, healing hands, Robert." Her voice dropped in a whisper. "Fail me not. Oh, fail me not." "Govern your fears," I said. "Return to your music. Be of good spirit, or if you cannot, make a show of it. I go now to treat your husband, and also to confront him with what you have told me." "Do not," she cried, "do not, I beseech you, Robert, lest in the event of your failure he devise foul embellishments upon the agonies into which he will cast me." "Very well," I said, "I will not speak of this to him, but my heart aches to learn the nature of the torments you fear." "Ask no more, Robert," she said, turning away. "Go to my husband, cure him. Then I will no longer fear those torments." I pressed her dear hand and left the salon. Sardonicus awaited me in his chambers. Thither quantities of hot water and stacks of towels had been brought by the servants upon my orders. Sardonicus was stripped to the waist, displaying a trunk strong and of good muscular, but with the same near phosphorescent pallor of his face. It was now, I understood, the pallor of one who has avoided daylight for years. "As you see, sir," he greeted me, "I am ready for your ministrations." I bade him recline upon his couch and began the treatment. Never have I worked so long with so little reward. After alternating applications of heat and of massage, over a period of 3 1/4 hours, I had made no progress. The muscles of his face were still as stiff as marble. They had not relaxed for an instant. I was mortally tired. He ordered our luncheon brought to us in his chambers, and after a short respite, I began again. The clock tolled 6 when I at last sank into a chair. Shaking with exhaustion and strain, his face was exactly as before. "What remains to be done, sir?" he asked me. "I will not deceive you," I said. "It is beyond my skill to alleviate your condition. I can do no more." He rose swiftly from the couch. "You must do more," he shrieked. "You are my last hope." "Sir," I said, "new medical discoveries are ever being made. Place your trust in him who created you." "Cease that detestable gibberish at once," he snapped. "Your puling sentiments sicken me. Resume the treatment." I refused. "I have applied all my knowledge, all my art, to your affliction," I assured him. "To resume the treatment would be idle and foolish, for, as you have divined, the condition is a product of your own mind." "At dinner last night, Counter Sardonicus, we spoke of the character of Macbeth. Do you not remember the words he addressed to his doctor? Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased, pluck from the memory a rooted sorrow, raise out the written troubles of the brain, and with sweet oblivious antidote cleanse the stuffed bosom of that perilous stuff which weighs upon the heart?" "I remember them," I said, "and I remember as well as the doctor's reply. Therein the patient must minister to himself." I rose and started for the door. "One moment, Sir Robert," he said. I turned. "Forgive my precipitous outburst a moment ago. However, the mental nature of my affliction notwithstanding, even though this mode of treatment has failed, surely there are other treatments." "None," I said, "that have been sufficiently tested. None I would venture to use upon a human body." "Ah," he cried, "then other treatments do exist." I shrugged. "Think not of them, sir. They are at present unavailable to you." I pitied him and added, "I am sorry." "Doctor," he said, "I implore you to use whatever treatment exists, be they ever so untried." "They are fraught with danger," I said. "Danger?" he laughed. "Danger of what? Of disfigurement? Surely no man has ever been more disfigured than I. Of death? I am willing to gamble my life." "I am not willing to gamble your life," I said. "All lives are precious, even yours. Sir Robert, I will pay you 1,000 pounds. "This is not a question of money." 5,000 pounds, Sir Robert. 10,000. No. He sank onto the couch. Very well, he said. Then I will offer you the ultimate inducement. Were it £1,000,000, I said, you could not sway me. The inducement I speak of, he said, is not money. Will you hear? I sat down. Speak, sir, I said, since that is your wish, but nothing will persuade me to use a treatment that might cost you your life. Sir Robert, he said, after a pause, yester eve, when I came down to meet you for the first time, I heard happy sounds in the salon. You were singing a charming melody with my wife. Later I could not help but notice the character of your glances towards her. They were not reciprocated, sir, I told him, and herewith I offer you a most abject apology for my unbecoming conduct. You obscure my point, he said. You are a friend of hers, from the old days in London. At that period you felt an ardent affection for her, I would guess. This is not surprising, for she is a lady whose face and form promise voluptuous delights, and yet a lady whose manner is most decorous and correct. I would guess further that your ardor has not diminished over the years, that at the sight of her the embers have burst into a flame. No, sir, hear me out. What would you say, Sir Robert, were I to tell you that you may quench that flame? I frowned. Your meaning, sir? Must I speak even more plainly? I am offering you a golden opportunity to requite the love that burns in your heart. Scoundrel! I roared, leaping up. He heeded me not, but went on speaking. As my guest, Sir Robert, I offer you a veritable oriental paradise of unlimited raptures. Enough, I cried. I will hear no more of your foulness. I strode to the door. Yes, you will, Sir Robert, he said immediately. You will hear a good deal more of my foulness. You will hear what I plan to do to your beloved Maud, should you fail to relieve me of this deformity. Again I stopped and turned. I said nothing but waited for him to speak further. I perceive that I have caught your interest, he said. Hear me, for if you think I spoke foully before, you will soon be forced to agree that my earlier words were by comparison as blameless as the Book of Common Prayer. If rewards do not tempt you, then threats may coerce you. In fine, Maud will be punished if you fail, Sir Robert. She is an innocent. Just so. Hence, the most exquisite and insupportable to you should be the thought of her punishment. My mind reeled. I could not believe such words were being uttered. Deep in the bowels of this old castle, said Sardonicus, are dungeons. Suppose I were to tell you that my intention is to drag my wife thither and stretch her smooth body to unendurable length upon the rack. You would not dare, I cried. My daring or lack of it is not the issue here. I speak of the rack only that I may go on to assure you that Maud would infinitely prefer that dreadful machine to the punishment I have in truth designed for her. I will describe it to you. You will wish to be seated, I think. Part 7. Entertainment for a Monster. I will stand, I said. As you please, Sardonicus himself sat down. Perhaps you have marveled at the very fact of Maud's marriage to me, when the world was so full of personable men, men like yourself who adored her. Why did she choose to wed a monster, a creature born to the eye, who did not, moreover, have any redeeming grace of spiritual beauty or kindness or charm? I first met Maud Randall in Paris. I say met, but it would be truer to simply say I saw her, from my hotel window, in fact. Even in Paris society, which abounds in ladies of remarkable pulchritude, she was to be remarked upon. You perhaps would say I fell in love with her, but I dislike that word love. I'll merely say that the sight of her smote my eye senses with most agreeable emphasis. I decided to make her mine. But how? By presenting my irresistibly handsome face to her view? Hardly. I began methodically. I hired secret operatives to find out everything about her and about her mother and father, both of whom were then alive. I discovered that her father was in the habit of speculating, so I saw to it that he received some supposedly trustworthy but very bad advice. He speculated heavily and was instantly ruined. I must admit I had not planned its consequent suicide, but when that melancholy event occurred, I rejoiced, for it worked to my advantage. I presented myself to the bereaved widow and daughter, telling them that the excellent qualities of Mr. Randall were widely known in the world of affairs and that I considered myself almost a close friend. I offered to help them in any possible way. By dint of excessive humility and persuasiveness, I won their trust and succeeded in diminishing their aversion to my face. This, you must understand, from first to last, occupied a period of many months. I spoke nothing of marriage, made no sign of affection towards the daughter for at least 6 of these months. When I did, again, with great respect and restraint, she gently refused me. I retreated gracefully, saying only that I hoped I might remain her and her mother's friend. She replied that she sincerely shared that hope, for although she could never look upon me as an object of love, she indeed considered me a true friend. The mother, who pined excessively after the death of the father, soon expired. Another incident, unplanned but welcomed by me. Now the lovely child was alone in the world in a foreign city, with no money, no one to guide her, no one to fall back upon, save kindly Mr. Sardonicus. I waited many weeks. Then I proposed marriage again. For several days she continued to decline the offer, but her declinations grew weaker and weaker until at length, on one day, she said this to me. "Sir, I esteem you highly as a friend and benefactor, but my other feelings towards you have not changed. If you could be satisfied with such a singular condition, if you could agree to enter into marriage with a lady, and yet look upon her as no more than a companion of kindred spirit, if the prospect of a dispassionate and childless marriage does not repulse you, as well as it might, then, sir, my unhappy circumstances would compel me to accept your kind offer." Instantly, I told her, my regard for her was of the purest and most elevated variety, that the urgings of the flesh were unknown to me, that I lived on a spiritual plane and desired only her sweet and stimulating companionship through the years. All this, of course, was a lie. The diametric opposite was true. But I hoped by this falsehood to lure her into marriage, after which by slow and strategic process I could bring about her submission and my rapture. She still was hesitant, for she frankly told me she believed that love was a noble and integral part of marriage, and that marriage without it could only be a hollow thing, and that though I knew not the urgings of the flesh, she could not with honesty say the same of herself. Yet she reiterated that, so far as my own person was concerned, a platonic relationship was all that could ever exist between us. I calmed her misgivings. We were married not long after. And now, Sir Robert, I will tell you a surprising thing. Not once in the years of our marriage, not once, I say, have I been able to persuade or cajole my wife into relenting and breaking the stringent terms of our marriage agreement. Each time I've attempted, she has recoiled from me with horror and disgust. This is not because of an abhorrence of all fleshly things, by her own admission, but because of my monstrous face. Perhaps now you will be better able to understand the vital necessity for this cure. And perhaps also you will understand the full extent of Maud's suffering should you fail to effect that cure. For mark me well, if you fail, my wife will be made to become a true wife to me by main force. I had been shocked into silence. I could only look upon him with disbelief. He spoke again. "If you deem it a light punishment, Sir Robert, then you do not know the depth of her loathing for my person. You do not know the revulsion that wells up inside her when I place my fingers upon her arm. You do not know what mastery of her very gorge is required of her when I kiss her hand. Think, then. Think of the abomination she would feel were my attentions to grow more ardent, more demanding. It would unseat her mind, sir, of that I am sure, for she would as soon embrace a reptile." Sardonicus arose and put on his shirt. "I suggest we both begin dressing for dinner," he said. "Whilst you are dressing, reflect. Ask yourself, Sir Robert, could you ever again look upon yourself with other than shame and loathing if you were to sacrifice the beautiful and blameless Maud Randall on an altar of the grossest depravity? Consider how ill you would sleep in your London bed, night after night, knowing that she was suffering at that very moment, suffering because you abandoned her, because you allowed her to become an entertainment for a monster." Part 8. A Token of Detestation. The days that passed after that time were, in the main, tedious yet filled with anxiety. During them, certain supplies were being brought from London and other places. Sardonicus spared no expense in procuring for me everything I said was necessary to the treatment. I avoided his society as much as I could, shunning even his table and instructing the servants to bring my meals to my rooms. On the other hand, I sought out the company of Maud, endeavoring to comfort her and allay her fears. In those hours when her husband was occupied with business affairs, we talked together in the salon and played music. Thus there were days spotted with small pleasures that seemed the greater for having been snatched in the shadow of wretchedness. I grew to know Maud, in that time, better than I had ever known her in London. Adversity stripped layers of ceremony from our congress, and we spoke directly. I came to know her warmth, but I came to know her strength, too. I spoke outright of my love, though, in the next breath, I assured her I was aware of the hopelessness of that love. I did not tell her of the reward her husband had offered me, and which I had refused, and I was gladdened to learn, as I did by indirection, that sardonic as though he had abjured her to be excessively cordial to me, had not revealed the ultimate and ignoble purpose of that cordiality. "Robert," she said once, "is it likely that he will be cured?" I did not tell her how unlikely it was. "For your sake, Maud," I said, "I will persevere more than I have ever done in my life." At length a day arrived when all the necessaries had been gathered, some plants from the New World, certain equipment from London, and a vital instrument from Scotland. I worked long and late in complete solitude, distilling a needed liquor from the plants. The next day dogs were brought to me alive and carried out dead. 3 days after that a dog left my laboratory alive, and my distilling labors came to an end. I informed Sardonicus that I was ready to administer the treatment. He came to my laboratory, and I imagined there was almost a gloating triumph in his immobile smile. "Such are the fruits of concentrated effort," he said. "Man is an indolent creature, but light the fire of fear under him, and of what miracles is he not capable?" "Speak not of miracles," I said, "though prayers would do you no harm now, for you'll soon be in peril of your life." I motioned him towards a table and bade him lie upon it. He did so, and I commenced explaining the treatment to him. "The explorer Magellan," I said, "wrote of a substance used on darts by the savage inhabitants of the South American continent. It killed instantly, dropping large animals in their tracks. The substance was derived from certain plants, and is in essence the same substance I have occupied in extracting these past days." "A poison, Sir Robert?" he asked wryly. "When used full strength," I said, "it kills by bringing about a total relaxation of the muscles, particularly the muscles of the lungs and heart. I've long thought that a dilution of that poison might beneficially slacken the rigidly tense muscles of paralyzed patients." "Most ingenious, sir," I said. "I must warn you," I went on, "that this distillment has never been used on a human subject. It may kill you. I must perforce urge you again not to insist upon its use, to accept your lot, and to remove the threat of punishment you now hold over your wife's head." "You seek to frighten me, doctor," chuckled Sardonicus, "to plant distrust in my bosom? But I fear you not. An English knight and a respected physician would never do a deed so dishonorable as to willingly kill a patient under his care. You would be hamstrung by your gentleman's code as well as by your professional oath. Your virtues are, in short, my vice's best allies." I bristled. "I am no murderer such as you," I said. "If you force me to use this treatment, I will do everything in my power to ensure its success. But I cannot conceal from you the possibility of your death." "See to it that I live," he said flatly, "for if I die, my men will kill both you and my wife. They will not kill you quickly. See to it also that I am cured, lest Maud be subjected to a fate she fears more than the slowest of tortures." I said nothing. "Then bring me this elixir straight away," he said, "and let me drink it off and make an end of this." "It is not to be drunk," I told him. He laughed. "Is it your plan to smear it on darts like the savages?" "Your jest is most opposite," I said, "and I indeed plan to introduce it into your bodies by means of a sharp instrument, a new instrument not yet widely known, that was sent me from Scotland. The original suggestion was put forth in the University of Oxford some 200 years ago by Dr. Christopher Wren, but only recently, through development by my friend Dr. Wood of Edinburgh, has it seemed practical. It is no more than a syringe. I showed him the instrument, attached to a needle, but the needle is hollow so that when it punctures the skin, it may carry healing drugs directly into the bloodstream." "The medical arts will never cease earning my admiration," said Sardonicus. "I filled a syringe. My patient said, 'Wait.'" "Are you afraid?" I asked. "Since that memorable night in my father's grave," he replied, "I have not known fear. I had a surfeit of it then. It will last out my lifetime. No, I simply wished to give instructions to one of my men. He arose from the table and, going to the door, told one of Helix to bring Madame Sardonicus to the laboratory. "Why must she be here?" I asked. "The sight of her," he said, "may serve you as a remembrance of what awaits her in the event of my death, or of that other punishment she may expect should your treatment prove ineffectual." Maud was brought into our presence. She looked upon my equipment, the bubbling retorts and tubes, the pointed syringe, with amazement and fright. I began to explain the principles of the treatment to her, but Sardonicus interrupted. "Madam is not one of your students, Sir Robert. It is not necessary she know these details. Delay no longer. Begin at once." He stretched out upon the table again, fixing his eyes upon me. I proffered Maud a comforting look and walked over to my patient. He did not wince as I drove the needle of the syringe into the left and then the right side of his face. "Now, sir," I said, and the tremor in my voice surprised me, "we must wait a period of 10 minutes. I joined Maud and talked to her in low tones, keeping my eyes always upon my patient. He stared at the ceiling. His face remained solidified in that unholy grin. Precisely 10 minutes later, a short gasp escaped him. I rushed to his side, and Maud followed close behind me. We watched with consuming fascination as that clenched face slowly softened, relaxed, changed, the lips drawing closer and closer to each other, gradually covering those naked teeth and gums, the craven creases unfolding and becoming smooth. Before a minute had passed, we were looking down upon the face of a serenely handsome man. His eyes flashed with pleasure, and he made as if to speak. "No," I said, "do not attempt speech yet. The muscles of your face are so slackened that it is beyond your power at present to move your lips. This condition will pass." My voice rang with exultation. For the moment, our enmity was forgotten. He nodded, then leapt from the table and dashed to a mirror which hung on a wall nearby. Though his face could not yet express his joy, his whole body seemed to unfurl in a greater gesture of triumph, and a muffled cry of happiness burst in his throat. He turned and seized my hand. Then he looked full into Maud's face. After a moment, she said, "I am happy for you, sir," and looked away. A rasping laugh sounded in his throat, and he walked to my workbench, tore a leaf from one of my notebooks and scribbled upon it. This he handed to Maud, who read it and passed it over to me. The writing said, "Fear not, lady, you will not be obliged to endure my embraces. I know full well that the restored beauty of my face will weigh not a jot in the balance of your attraction and repugnance. By this document I dissolve our pristine marriage. You who have been a wife only in name are no longer even that. I give you your freedom." I looked up from my reading. Sardonicus had been writing again. He ripped another leaf from the notebook and handed it directly to me. It read, "This paper is your safe conduct out of the castle and into the village. Gold is yours for the asking, but I doubt if your English scruples will countenance the acceptance of my money. I will expect you to have quit these premises before morning, taking her with you. We will be gone within the hour," I told him, and guided Maud towards the door. Before we left the room, I turned for the last time to Sardonicus. "For your unclean threats," I said, "for the indirect but no less vicious murder of this lady's parents, for the defiling of your own father's grave, for the greed and inhumanity that moved you even before your blighted face provided you with an excuse for your conduct, for these and for what crimes unknown to me blacken your ledger, accept this token of my censure and detestation." I struck him forcibly on the face. He did not respond. He was standing there in the laboratory when I left the room with Maud. Part 9. Not God above, nor the fiend below. This strange account should probably end here. No more can be said of its central character, for neither Maud nor I saw him or heard of him after that night. And of us two, nothing need be imparted other than the happy knowledge that we had been most contentedly married for the past 12 years, and are the parents of a sturdy boy and 2 girls who are the lovely images of their mother. However, I have mentioned my friend Lord Henry Stanton, the inveterate traveler and faithful letter writer, and I must copy out now a portion of a missive I received from him only a week since, and which in point of fact has been the agent and has prompted me to unfold the whole history of Mr. Sardonicus. "But, my dear Bobby," wrote Stanton, "in truth there is small pleasure to be found in this part of the world, and I shall be glad to see London again. The excitements and the drama have all departed, if indeed they ever existed, and one must content oneself with the stories told at the hearthstones of inns, with the flames crackling and the mulled wine agreeably stinging one's throat. The natives here are most fond of harrowing stories, tales of gore and gruel, of ghosts and ghouls and ghastly events, and I must confess a partiality to such entertainments myself. They will show you a stain on a wall and tell you it is the blood of a murdered innocent who met her death there 50 years before. No amount of washing will ever remove that stain, they tell you, in sepulchral tones, and indeed it deepens and darkens on a certain day of the year, the anniversary of her violent passing. One is expected to nod gravely, of course, and one does, if one wishes to encourage the telling of more stories. Back in the 11th century, you will be apprised, a battalion of foreign invaders were vanquished by the skeletons of long-dead patriots who rose from their tombs to defend their homeland and then returned to the earth when the enemy had been driven from their borders. And since they are able to show you the very graves of these lively bones, how can one disbelieve them, Bobby? Or they will point out to a desolate skull of a castle. The country here abounds in such depressing piles, and tell you the spectral tyrant, who a scant dozen years before despaired and died alone there, deserted by the minions who had always hated him. The frightening creature roamed the village, livid and emaciated, his mind shattered, mutely imploring the succor of even the lowliest beggars. I say mutely, and that is the best part of this tall tale. For as they tell it around the fire, these inventive folk, these poor unfortunate, could not speak, could not eat, and could not drink. You ask why? For the simple reason that, though he clawed most horribly at his own face, and though he enlisted the aid of strong men, he was absolutely unable to open his mouth. Cursed by Lucifer, they say, he thirsted and starved in the midst of plenty, surrounded by kegs of drink and tables full of the choicest viands, suffering the tortures of Tantalus until he finally died. Ah, Bobby, the efforts of our novelist are pale stuff compared to this. English literatures have not the shameless wild imaginations of these people. I will never again read Mr. Radcliffe's Pleasure, I assure you. The ghost of King Hamlet will, from this day hence, strike no terror to my soul, and will fill my heart with but paltry pity. Still, I have journeyed in foreign climes quite enough for one trip, and I long for England and that good English dullness which is relieved only by you and your dear lady, to whom you must commend me most warmly. Until next month, I remain your wayward friend, Harry Stanton. Now, it would not be a difficult feat for the mind to instantly assume that the unfortunate man in that last tale was Sardonicus. Indeed, it is for that reason that I have not yet shown Stanton's letter to Maud, for she, albeit she deeply loathes Sardonicus, is of such a compassionate and susceptible nature that she would grieve to hear him suffering a death so horrible. But I am a man of science, and I do not form conclusions on such gossamer evidence. Harry did not mention the province of Bohemia that is supposed to have been the stage of that terrible drama, and his letter, though written in Bohemia, was not mailed by Harry until he reached Berlin, so the postmarks tells me nothing. Castles like that of Sardonicus are not singular in Bohemia. Harry himself says the country abounds in such depressing piles. So I plan to suspend conclusive thoughts in the matter until I welcome Harry home and can elicit from him details of the precise locality. For if that desolate skull of a castle is Castle Sardonicus, and if the story of the starving man is to be believed, then I will be struck by an awesome and curious thing. 5 days I occupied myself in extracting a liquor from the South American plants. During those days, dogs were carried dead from my laboratory. I deliberately killed the poor creatures with the undiluted poison in order to impress Sardonicus with its deadliness. I never intended to, and in fact never did, prepare a safe dilution of that lethal drug, for its properties were too unknown, its potentiality too dangerous. The liquid I injected into Sardonicus was pure distilled water. Nothing more. This has always been my plan. The ordering of materia medica from far-flung lands was but an elaborate facade designed to work not upon the physical part of Sardonicus, but upon his mind. For after Keller, Morignac, Boagente, and my own massaging techniques had failed, I was convinced that it was only through his mind that his body could be cured. It was necessary to persuade him, however, that he was receiving a powerful medicament. His mind, I had hoped, would provide the rest, as in truth it did. If the tale of that spectral tyrant proved true, then we must look upon the human mind with wonderment and terror. For in that case it was nothing, nothing corporeal, to prevent the wretched creature from opening his mouth and eating his fill. Alone in that castle, food a plenty at his fingertips, he has suffered a dire punishment which came upon him, to paraphrase Sardonicus' very words, not from God above or the fiend below, but from within his own breast, his own brain, his own soul.